The English landscape, with its little fields bounded by tidy, neat hedges, is part of popular consciousness. But if we had a time-lapse film taken from a satellite high up above, what we'd see would be a constant pulsing as open spaces ebb and flow, grow and shrink.
You remember me when the west wind moves upon the fields of Bali. You forget the sun in his jealous sky as we walk in fields of gold.
This series is going to try and offer some snapshots from the time-lapse film. It's going to try and look at the forces that shape our idea of the field. Sixpenny Handley in Dorset is named after two Saxon hundreds called Saxpenner and Handlager. It's nothing to do with money. I've climbed up to the top of the tower of the Church of St. Mary the Virgin, looking out over the Cranbourne Chase. It's a landscape of open fields, just the boundaries really have got any trees on them. The reason I've come up here is that I'm told that from here we can see Down Farm, which is your farm, Martin Green. Where is it?
It's over there. You can see what we call Fir Tree Field in the distance. It's been in our family for about three generations, and I've been exploring the archaeology of it for about 35 years, and I've got some very detailed results of the first farmers and the hunter-gatherers who exploited this area thousands of years ago.
And they're the people who created the fields?
That's right. In prehistory, we got the first evidence of settlements and the creation of a landscape with fields and crops and so forth.
Just before we leave the church, you're peering very intently at the font, Martin.
Yes, I've just realised that it's made of a rock called Purbeck marble, which was quarried in the south of Dorset, and it's a freshwater limestone full of snails. And the thing about the snails is, of course, I've got my friend and colleague here, Dr. Mike Allen from Wessex Archaeology, who's going to tell us a lot about the landscape and the development of fields from the evidence of snails.
You know, the snails here in these Purbeck marbles have geological time period, but what we're really interested in is the land snails of archaeological time period, because they can tell us about people and fields.
We're sitting on a pile in the middle of the field, and the pile is actually the spoil from one of your digs. Is that right?
That's right.
In front of us now are open sort of pasture land, a few trees on the border, way over there a few more trees in a kind of hedgerow. But how do you go about saying, well, we're going to work out what it looked like 8,000 years ago?
You need two things. One, you need some good archaeological sites in which there are deposits. And secondly, you need a Martin Green who can come along and dig them up for you and date them. And then we can actually take soil samples out of dated horizons from thousands of years ago and then build that picture up slowly. So I spend much of my time looking at land snails. Not the garden snail you see rushing around eating your cabbages in the garden, but microscopic snails. Most of these are adults. They're only a couple of millimetres in size when they're adult, and archaeologically when we find them, they're actually smashed into smithereens.
Okay, you've produced here some little glass tubes full of, well, actually quite big snails. I mean, I can recognise those as snails, and some of them look like dust. What's the story in these tubes then?
Well, these are all snails from sites on Down Farm. Different species, each tube has a different species in it. Some of those species belong in woodland, some like living in long grass, some in decayed vegetation. And therefore, we can work out the proportions of them and say precisely what the environment was at a particular time. And I asked Martin to tell me what that time was, because he is the archaeologist, I'm just the ecologist.
So Martin, what first made you dig deeper than a plough?
It was a pure chance discovery in 1976 due to the great drought. We had mains water installed, and during the digging of the pipe trench it cut through a prehistoric ditch, and I wanted to know more about that ditch, what was its purpose and so forth, and so I started excavating.
But how did you know it was a prehistoric ditch?
We found a few artefacts in it, a few bits of pottery and flint tools that gave the game away.
And then what?
And then over the course of 3.5 years I totally stripped what turned out to be a Bronze Age settlement. And gradually, as we stripped the topsoil away and exposed the chalk surface, we started to find pits and post holes of features where there had obviously been buildings in the past.
And how old was it?
About 3,000 years old.
So that's quite advanced in terms of the history of fields 3,000 years ago?
by the time the people were living here in that 2,000-year-old settlement, the landscape had been completely transformed from thousands of years previously by human intervention to turn it into that landscape.
Can you work out how they did it? How did they... I mean, OK, there were clearings in the woods, but how did they get rid of the trees?
They did that with a number of ways. You can either burn them down, or you can just migrate where the trees are naturally falling into those areas and exploit those natural huge openings. Or there are suggestions you can ring bark things and then come back. So there is a case of planning and thought.
As a farmer, Martin, can you put yourself in their position and sort of see yourself carving fields out of the woods?
Yeah, stone axes are very efficient tools, really. I've done experiments myself when I've cut down small trees using them. So, you know, they would have had the technology to be able to do it.
Is there a moment at which you reckon, instead of being an open woodland, is there a moment at which it became a field?
The landscape is starting to be used in the Neolithic. People were starting to clear areas. They were starting to cultivate small patches within an existing sort of mainly wooded area. And of course the Neolithic period lasts for 2,000 years, so it's a vast period, and we're trying to sort of get some resolution of how the landscape developed over that very long period of time.
Well, we've come around the back of the spoil heap and walked out onto a kind of tiny little seaside pier or gantry. And if I peer over the side of it, I'm looking down into a very deep hole. How big is it?
It's about 13 metres deep by about 10 metres wide at the top.
And how far back in history does the bottom layer take you?
The earliest dates we got for this shaft are about 4,500 BC, right at the end of the Mesolithic or hunter-gatherer period.
When you were digging this hole, were you looking for anything specific, or were you just digging a hole?
Well, no, the site originally appeared as a remarkable crop mark in the grass one year. Suddenly the grass became very rank and I could see this patch, and I thought it was something archaeological and maybe of interest to the sites that I'd already excavated here. And we just started excavating, not really knowing what we'd were going to encounter, and it just went down and down and down. There must have been at one time an underground cavern in the chalk, and then all of a sudden it collapsed, and we think that happened round about 4,500, 5,000 BC. And then it became a wonderful trap, that hole, for a whole sequence of soils to erode into. People were aware of it in the landscape, they were coming to visit it, and people regarded these features as perhaps symbolic entrances into Mother Earth, that kind of nature, and they wanted to bury their dead. And perhaps by building mounds of chalk, they are in some way sort of commemorating their dead and comparing them to the natural phenomena we see in the landscape today.
Do you want to be buried in this hole?
Not in this one, but I'd like to be buried on the farm not too far away, because I spent a large proportion of my life in this field. Well, welcome to the museum, or one man's obsession, as I like to call this.
Looks like a chicken hut to me.
Well, it was originally, of course.
But was it really?
Yes, it was. But now it's, as I say, my archaeological museum.
And here you've got a little case, finds from within the shaft. And these are wonderful. What are they?
Well, here we've got a range of Neolithic pottery. This is called plain bowl, or sometimes windmill hill pottery. And this is the first pottery vessels which were produced in Britain. And we've got dates for the layer from which the pottery came of about 4,000 BC. And that's a little flint arrowhead, which we found at a higher level, dating to the early Bronze Age, perhaps about 2,000 BC.
So the people were still hunting then? They weren't pure farmers?
Yes, I mean, people have been hunting ever since the year dot, and right up until the medieval period, so we don't see a complete transition.
Skeleton curled up in a little hole.
Yes, this was found very close to the Bronze Age settlement that we were talking about earlier, and I think this man would have been one of the occupants of that settlement.
And he's been sort of tucked up into a fetal position. I mean, this is very deliberate stuff.
Very much so. I mean, we think they must have been bound up, sort of perhaps wrapped in textiles as a kind of mummy bundle to be placed in this fetal position, as you say. And I think it's because they have a belief in the afterlife to be put back into the fetal position to be reborn in the next world. And they're placing people back in Mother Earth, if you like.
When do you start seeing evidence of settlements, of what we might call a village or a farmhouse or a farmstead?
In this area, round about sort of 4,500 years ago.
And what would that have looked like?
You'd had a group of probably thatched houses, mainly round houses, occasional rectangular buildings with wattle-door walls and a series of fences and enclosures defining the settlement.
And around the settlement, was that where they were farming?
That's right. We've got evidence from our Middle Bronze Age site that there are a series of fields outside, some of which were being used to grow arable crops, others for pasture, for animals and so forth.
What kind of size were they?
They're quite small plots. It's what we call Celtic fields today. So they'd be a range of small plots defined by a fence, most likely, and gradually over time, due to soil movement, there would banks would build up around these fence lines and produce the sort of earthwork field systems which we know on the Downs today.
And how were they working the fields?
They would have been using animals, particularly oxen, so for traction, simple types of ploughs, which we call ards, which would simply scratch through the surface of the soil to produce a tilth in which they could plant their crops. It would have been a pretty tough life, I think.
Why do you think they stuck with it? I mean, was the game running out, or what was happening?
It's a whole ideological and sociological change. You're actually organising yourself as a community, and therefore you can stay in one place for a long periods of time. But that is, again, a big risk. If it doesn't work, you're into starvation.
The Bible talks about the farmers working by the sweat of their faces, I think. You know, it's a much harder life, isn't it?
It's a much harder life preparing the land, they're arding it, just scratching the soil. Everything has to be done by hand. When they're cultivating the crops, the top, the ear is actually picked off by hand. And then once you've picked off all the ears, you then go back and reap the straw, perhaps for bedding or for thatching or for fodder. So yes, it's a very hard time.
Were they looking after livestock as well?
We always talk about farmers and immediately think of fields of corn and grain, but in fact the first farmers were really farming animals. They were herding cattle. That was the first thing. That's the transition from hunting them to herding them, domesticating them and farming them.
And killing them when you wanted to rather than when they came by.
Kill them when you want to, but then also you've got the dairy products, so you've got your milk, your butter, your cheese.
Where did they get domesticated cattle?
The first wild cattle, well, aurochs, were huge beasts. They stood taller than your eye, they had huge horns on them. They were quite ferocious looking beasts, and yet someone decided if we could corral these and herd these in a field, perhaps we could make them pets and keep them. But that's what they did.
Martin, above the chap buried in his pit is a collection of what look like cow skulls. Are they from the farm?
They are, yes. There's been a certain amount of selective breeding on these species. They're not aurochs, but they're the one at the top, which is 5,000 years old, is closer to it than the other three, so there's been quite a significant amount of selectivity in the breeding to produce these types. The skull changes shape, and you get this sort of pronounced sort of dome shape. Obviously they weren't trying to do that, but when they were selecting other features, incidentally they're altering the shape of the skull as well.
To begin with, Mike, that presumably these settlements were quite scattered and few and far between. Did they have to worry about, you know, the chaps from the next valley coming over and stealing the crop just before they were ready to harvest?
Initially that wasn't an issue. There was plenty of land, plenty of landscape. You could put your field anywhere. The only time you might want to have any relationships with other communities is purely as insurance, that you have friends if your crop doesn't come up. But essentially, they're growing crops in fields, but as those fields grew and as they had bigger and bigger systems, so they start to take up more and more of the landscape. And by the late Bronze Age, perhaps 3,000 years ago, we can start seeing field systems abutting each other. Also, the soil is eroding, the soils are getting thinner, and therefore perhaps we could argue that therefore the same amount of fields are producing less food, less crop, less yield. So they're expanding more and more, and that's when ownership gets into the situation, where territoriality comes in, when huge bits of the entire chalk downlands are carved off and blocked off in huge field systems. And that's when your crop, your gold, becomes rare. And that's when it is worth nicking. And that's precisely the time when we move from the late Bronze Age into the Iron Age, when we start getting hill forts, defended enclosures on top of the hill. And what they're defending is people and their food. They're full of grain pits.
They're full of stored food from the fields outside.
Precisely. The only time it's worth stealing the crop is when somebody else has done all the hard work and taken it off the field and put it into store. That's when you go and raid someone else's larder.
What's your favourite piece in the museum? I mean, if we did the old desert island thing and said, well, you can have one of them to take away with you.
Well, there's a wonderful polished flint knife that I found some years ago. And being a bit of a flint aficionado. I think this is a wonderful example of flint craftsmanship.
Now, you say that's a knife. It's about the size of a cigarette packet and about as thick as a couple of credit cards. And that's remarkable.
It is. Although it's called a knife, we don't really think it was used as a cutting tool. It's just a name which archaeologists have given it to differentiate it from other articles. But I think it must have been a prestigious object and may have had a ritual function.
And how do you think it was polished and shaped? Because it doesn't have that kind of flaky texture of flints.
Now, originally they would have flaked it to the rough outline, and then they would have had to grind it down on a block of sandstone with water over a very, very long period of time.
Because it's got a sort of chamfered edge as well,
hasn't it? It has, yes. They're remarkable objects.
How did you find it?
Just field walking on the surface of a ploughed field. When I first picked it up, I thought it was plastic or slate. I couldn't believe it was actually flint. Then when I realised it was flint, I just thought, this is a most extraordinary object. And even if I go on walking ploughed fields to the age of 100, I'm never going to beat a piece like that.
Mike, when you see a flint knife like that, and you think of the sort of hours and hours you put in with your eyes glued to a binocular microscope sorting out fragments of shell, Wouldn't you rather be doing field walking and picking up bits of knife?
That's all very fun, and I mean, some of the objects are absolutely smashing, but what they are is essentially the bookmarks in the book of history. They are telling me about the times at which things have occurred, and what I'm really doing is telling the story. So the reason I do sit at the microscope for all that time is, at the end of the day, I'm actually dead interested in the story it's going to tell me, and Martin provided me with the bookmarks and the time marks for that story.
Not a flint's throw from Martin Green's down farm in the heart of Cranbourne Chase. It looks like woodland rather than fields, but in front of me is a large mound, and next to me is Andy Poor, forestry consultant to the Rushmore Estate, who says that the mound is a Neolithic or Bronze Age burial mound.
It's one of a set of seven Bronze Age burial mounds set in what is now a large block of coppice woodlands.
At the moment, we're sort of huddled under the rain in a woodland of what, spruce and some other beech and maybe even some oak. How long has it been like this, and what was it before?
That's really like it's been for the last probably 1,000 years over there.
Was this agricultural before it became woodland? Were these open fields?
Well, it appears that there was a significant area of clearance in the Bronze Age here, but subsequently there was woodland reinvasion, and the woodlands have been here ever since.
So why were they tolerated? Why did people allow these woodlands to invade, and then why were they tolerated?
Well, by the time we get to the Iron Age and the Roman period, these woodlands became a valuable resource. They realised they had to maintain them and conserve them to produce things they needed, which was firewood. The system was to cut whatever was here on a rotation. It could have been 10 to 15 years, and that produced an annual supply of firewood. There would have been areas of cultivated fields around the settlement. There would have been pastures available, grass pastures on the downland. But remember also that the woodlands would have been used for grazing as well as firewood production.
And the chase itself seems to have been fun rather than farming. I mean, it seems that the nobles would come herring through here after their deer and what have you.
Originally, it was all to do with keeping alive. The local populace used this area in order to maintain themselves. Later on, with the introduction of the chase rights, you're right, there was an element of recreation. Though really, it was still about hard economics in the end.
To what extent did the fact that the nobles were keeping this really as a deer park, how did that affect the development of agriculture here and roundabout?
Yes, the existence of the chase rights effectively restricted their ability to improve farmland by breaking up downland or by clearing woodland.
So what were these chase rights?
The rights to kill deer over this very large area, but also a whole other range of things. You had to seek permission to cut down trees, to enclose areas of woodland or to enclose fields.
So did that stop the development of fields?
Yes, I think it restricted the breaking up of downland and the clearance of woodland. And when the chase rights were removed in 1828, on a lot of estates around Rushmore, there was extensive woodland clearance and downland being ploughed up. And that was repeated again in the middle of the 20th century.
Driving up here, I saw that the recent cuts of hazel, the recent coppicing, had very high fences around. Presumably that's to keep the deer out. Are they a problem?
They are a problem if you're trying to produce high-quality hazel, absolutely.
So would you like to see the nobles back here chasing the deer and keeping the populations down?
Yes, in short.
Quite by chance, really, This whole area of the Cranbourne Chase was inherited by General Augustus Lane Fox Pitt Rivers, who, as it so happened, was one of the first scientific archaeologists and who set about excavating the early evidence of the first farmers in this area. The museum he created in the village has now mostly moved to the Salisbury and South Wiltshire Museum, where Martin Wright is the assistant curator. What did Pitt Rivers bring to the study of early settlement?
I think he was most important because he was one of the earliest serious archaeologists to actually investigate the settlement evidence for the early peoples of Britain. His predecessors had focused on barrows, the monuments. He was the first person really to take settlement evidence seriously, plot possible post holes for signs of settlement, that type of thing. He was the first person to really get to grips with the ordinary everyday life of the people that lived in these settlements. We have several good examples here. The village, the Roman British village of Woodcuts in Dorset, also up on Cranbourne Chase. He excavated quite a large area of it, and we're able now, after re-examination, to see the development of this site through the Roman period, right from the 1st century, right the way through, indeed, till the 5th century.
So in the late 1880s, 1890s, when Pitt Rivers was working, what kinds of things was he finding out about the way the Romans changed the later Iron Age settlements?
We know in that period that the production of grain and cereals is certainly very, very important as far as the Romans are concerned, that the significance of Britain as being a source of agricultural products, particularly cereals.
So the fields were becoming bigger?
Yes, to become much more large scale. The legions themselves needed to be fed. Rome itself starved without supplies from Egypt. If there's famine, if there's plague, you need reliable sources of grain, and Britain was certainly one of those.
The early farmers had already developed several kinds of technologies. Did the Romans bring anything specific and new with them that changed the way farming was carried out?
The biggest impact, I'm sure, would be in transport. The roads themselves would have allowed the transport of goods over greater distances, and that movement itself would have opened up wider areas of the country for agricultural production in order to transport that material to the towns. The towns rely upon the country for their survival. Towns are new in this country when the Romans arrive. In order for them to survive, they need the countryside.
So 2,000 years ago, we've got a similar set of forces to 50 years ago, expanding the sizes of fields, getting rid of markers, intensifying production.
Yes, in some respects. I mean, there is the example of there's a harvesting machine that's used by the Romans, which we do see.
A harvesting?
Yes, it's almost an early combine harvester, which was actually pushed, we think, by oxen would be the most likely thing.
So when the Romans leave and the towns start to collapse, mm-hmm. the fields would shrink, the fields would be taken over by woodlands?
Well, yes, in many cases. But what we're finding is that the impression that's given that the countryside is now becoming empty, I think is probably a misleading one. We're finding more and more evidence that fields continue in use.
Away on the other side of the estate, there are the Llama Tree Pleasure Gardens, and I've managed to find shelter here from the rain in a glorious black and white building. On the other side of a large lawn, there's another black and white building, which is one of the Indian buildings, created from the debris of an exhibition in the 1890s. Across the way from that, there's a lovely little round sort of pepper pot, which is a temple building. And on the fourth side of this lovely lawn, there's a huge black building, which is a theatre. Emma Chambers, manager of the Llama Tree Gardens, what on earth is a theatre doing facing the lawn of a pleasure garden?
This garden was set up as a place of enlightenment and education. So General Pitt Rivers, in creating this garden, wanted to show the local populace the range of buildings from around the world and also to entertain them. He wanted to offer people different entertainment on Sundays. That was a very important part of the formation of Llama Tree. And so on the stage there was poetry readings, small plays and other small productions.
Who was this General Pitt Rivers who had this extraordinary idea of turning the Chase into an educational pleasure garden?
He was originally Lane Fox, and he inherited the estate. He was the second son of a second son, and in 1880, by just amazing coincidence, really. He inherited the, I think it was 40,000 acres at that time, Rushmore Estate, which was a huge part of the Cranbourne Chase. And he'd been almost a disciple of Darwin's, where Darwin was looking at the evolution of the species. General Pitt Rivers was interested in the evolution of the implement. And so he had a huge knowledge and a wish to show people, to educate people to his philosophy, and also to make sure that people were more educated to be able to decide their own destiny, perhaps.
People don't nowadays come out into the country to pleasure gardens to hear poetry readings. So how are you using the space now?
When the gardens were reopened in the early 1990s by Michael Pitt Rivers, the great grandson of General Pitt Rivers, and I think very much part of his philosophy was that the gardens would continue to be a place of public entertainment. So we still put on music every Sunday afternoon throughout the summer, and then for July the gardens closes to the day visitors, and we have two large music festivals here. One's the Llama Tree Music Festival, at which people like Jules Holland and Van Morrison have played, and the other is the Big Chill Festival, which is a London-based festival which does events all around the world, and they take the gardens for one weekend.
Do you think it's slightly odd, having moved from a sort of self-improving Victorian ethos of poetry readings and education to a weekend of chilling out?
No, I don't. I think it's just the natural progression, really. It was all about relaxing and talking to people, and that's really how it's still used. When we walked in fields
of gold. It seems an awful long way from Neolithic hunter-gatherers to ravers down from London. But the fact is that people have always changed the ways they use the open fields they've created. Next week, I'll be looking at perhaps the biggest change of all, the enclosures.